I actually took this idea from my husband, Anthony. I gotta give him credit. But basically, when I was making the decision to leave Fortune, one of the stupidest considerations I had was, yeah, but like, if I leave, I'll no longer be, you know, writer and editor at Fortune magazine, and that sounds really damn good. And when I leave, I'll be what? Paulina Marinova with the profile? And he was like, nothing is more powerful than tying your identity to your own name, because nobody can take that away from you. You can get fired, you can lose your job, your status, your everything, but nobody can take away your name. The reason that's powerful, and I think in your question you said, I'm just Paulina or I'm just Bilal, but think about it. When Oprah walks into a room, she's not just Oprah, she's Oprah. And nobody is like, so what do? You know what I mean? Her name is her brand. So I think that that's been really eye-opening for me. And the biggest advice that I ever give new graduates is make sure that you're working on some sort of passion project or something on the side that you do for yourself. You don't have to figure out how it will make money or whether it will make money. Just do something for yourself so that if you ever get into that situation or you lose your job, you're laid off, you have something to fall back on that you do with your own name.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's conversation is with Paulina Marinova Pompliano, the author of The Profile, a newsletter that profiles the world's most successful people. Previously, she spent 5 years at Fortune magazine, where she was the author and editor of Termsheet, an industry-leading newsletter on deal-making. Paulina has interviewed some of the most influential dealmakers in the world, including Melinda Gates, Chamath Palihapitiya, and Steve Case. In this conversation, we discuss the rise of independent writers like her and the creator economy at large, the evolution of the media landscape, and the future of media monetization. We go into her writing process and the art of the edit. We also go into some actionable lessons learned from The Profile, featuring people like Malcolm Gladwell, Charlie Munger, Anthony Bourdain, Ira Glass, Elon Musk, and many more. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and Paulina is at Paulina_Marinova. Links in the description. You can watch all of this on YouTube visually. If you prefer that, just go to youtube.com/creatorlabfm. And if you're new here, make sure you checked out last week's conversation with Cortland Allen, the founder of Indie Hackers, and subscribe for upcoming conversations with Andrew Wilkinson from Tiny and Gagan Biyani, the founder of Udemy. Now let's get straight into the show. Paulina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, listen, I've been following your work for a while. You're one of my favorite followers on Twitter as well. You share a lot of great stuff on there. We're going to go into your full background and how you've built The Profile. And you've really been sitting at the cutting edge of new media. So we're going to dive into a little bit of that today, as well as lessons learned from your amazing writing. But before we go into that, I'd love just for you to just paint a picture of where you are today. With The Profile and a little bit about how you kind of landed there.
Yeah, so I spent the last 5 years as a writer at Fortune magazine, covering entrepreneurship, business, venture capital, private equity, all the fun stuff. And I left on March 20th. I started working full-time on The Profile, even though I founded it 3 years ago. This year was the first time I took it independent, and so far I've loved it. The only challenging thing has been that I've identified as a writer my whole life. So now when people ask what you do, I'm like, writer, entrepreneur, I don't know, both. So it's interesting how when your identity evolves, it's so hard to like move on to the new one.
Well, that's kind of why I've chosen the word creator for the show, because I felt like it encapsulated kind of everything in a way, selfishly, because it was like you're creating, whether you're writing, you're creating a business, you're kind of creating changes and reinventing yourself. So that's kind of how I honed in on my own kind of identity as well. You actually mentioned something there about identity and it being tied to your kind of past. I've heard you mention before that you had this like this big brand behind you, right? Fortune, and this kind of a safety net with that, right? When you meet people, they'll say, what do you do? And you say, oh, I write for Fortune. And people just instantly have respect because of a brand like that. And there's this thing that a lot of people go through. I've gone through it myself, where you leave a big brand and then you're just Polina or you're just Bilal. And you kind of have to get that self-esteem back almost, or like confidence in your own brand. I'm just curious, like, what was that like for you?
So luckily, I had learned that lesson the really hard way. After I graduated from college, I had always been a student up until that point. That was my identity. I was the editor-in-chief of my college paper. That was another identity. I was an intern. That was a third identity. An intern for, like, prestigious media brands, right? CNN, USA Today. But then, when I graduated, all of that went away. I, up until that point, at least the most basic identity was student. Suddenly, I was just Polina Marinova. And there was nothing, and I desperately tried to tie. I was like, well, sometimes I freelance for CNN. I was just really desperately trying to wrap my identity around something external to sound impressive. And if you notice, a lot of young people, when they go to a party, somebody says, what do you do? Or who are you? Or, you know, where are you in life? You answer with the most impressive identity that you have. So I kind of got addicted to that. It can be addicting. So I really, really struggled because suddenly I couldn't get a job. I was living at home with my mom. I had to move back home. So I was like literally the cliche, and she would make jokes like, oh, so funny, your new office is the couch. And I was like, please stop. Like, you're literally hurting my self-esteem even more. And then when I go to, like, all my friends had really great jobs, and somebody would invite me to their company party or something like that. And when they would ask me, like, so what do you do? And I was just like, oh, not again. That taught me a really important lesson about tying your identity to something external, because the second that that external thing goes away, your self-worth typically goes with it. And that is a very dangerous place. That is why you hear about all these people who, when they retire from these big time CEOs, and suddenly they retire and they go through a really hard time because they don't know how to identify themselves anymore and they don't know who they are. So I actually took this idea from my husband, Anthony. I gotta give him credit. But basically, when I was leaving, when I was making the decision to leave Fortune, one of the stupidest considerations I had was, yeah, but like, if I leave, I'll no longer be, you know, writer and editor at Fortune magazine, and that sounds really damn good. And when I leave, I'll be what, Polina Marinova with the profile? And he was like, nothing is more powerful than tying your identity to your own name, because nobody can take that away from you. You can get fired, you can lose your job, your status, your everything, but nobody can take away your name. The reason that's powerful, and I think in your question you said, I'm just Polina or I'm just Bilal, but think about it. When Oprah walks into a room, she's not just Oprah, she's Oprah. And nobody is like, so what do? You know what I mean? Her name is her brand. So I think that that's been really eye-opening for me. And the biggest advice that I ever give new graduates is make sure that you're working on some sort of passion project or something on the side that you do for yourself. You don't have to figure out how it will make money or whether it will make money. Just do something for yourself so that if you ever get into that situation or you lose your job, you're laid off, you have something to fall back on that you do with your own name.
I love that so much. Yeah, I heard, so for people that don't know, the husband you reference is Anthony Pompliano, who's Pomp, who's on the show a few episodes ago. I think a lot of people go through that, whether that's becoming self-employed or like having an identity outside of work, or to be honest, even in personal life, like when people break up in a relationship and they were the girlfriend or boyfriend of so-and-so or the mother of their children, of course that's part of your identity, but like if you don't create your own identity, you're always going to have that problem. So that really great lesson in there. So just to rewind a little bit, so you mentioned Fortune magazine, you were writing daily for them. Then you've created the profile, which has been going on for a few years. I think three years, is it?
Three and a half.
And you've been full-time most of this year, so 2020, the crazy year we've all had. So take me back to that moment of knowing when to leave, because like a lot of people do something on the side, it never becomes a full-time thing. And that's something a lot of people dream of doing. So what was going through your head at that time to make that decision and make you feel comfortable to do it?
Yes. So just to preface all of this, I am the most risk-averse person on the planet. And that is probably because my parents and I immigrated from Bulgaria when I was 8 to Atlanta, Georgia. I saw that process. It was really difficult to come from another country, move to the South, think you know English, and then you realize, no, you don't know English when people are like, hey, y'all. And I'm like, what the hell is a y'all? But basically, because of their willingness to take such a big risk, I became extremely risk averse because my hope was I never want to work 3 jobs to support my family. I want a nice, safe corporate job that will take care of me forever. I mean, and truly, I never thought I would leave Fortune magazine. But I think it's something in the genes or in the blood or in the water where at a certain point, I was like, what's my next chapter? I can't just keep doing the same thing. I think after a while, you realize like I need some excitement in my life. And if I don't do this now, I'm literally going to stay here for the rest of my life. And so when I started thinking about it, again, important to say that I did not start the profile thinking it would ever be a business or let alone that I would ever leave my job for it. So when I started it, I genuinely started it out of a love for profiles. That is all. And interesting conversations, because the profile was my medium through which I got to meet such interesting people and have great conversations about them and nerd out. So that's what it was for me. But then as Substack kind of began to rise and as more people started Substacks, and in January of this year, I started my question to myself was, what would the profile look like if I worked on it full time? Because I kept having these great ideas, but then I was like, damn, I can't do that because it would be in conflict with Fortune. So I couldn't do certain things because I had another job in media. And once I started playing with the idea of like, well, I would do this and this, and I had so many things that I wanted to do, and one, not enough time because I was only working on the profile on evenings and on the weekends. So you know, when you, it's so cliche and it's so funny, but it's true. When you get something in your head and your brain kind of struggles with the decision, but you find yourself swaying on the side of like everything I started reading and listening to, every podcast, every newsletter, every article was like, you should leave your job and start something new. Like, I don't know how, but like those were the things that were sticking with me. And it's a little bit like confirmation bias, but I read an article about like how in this new world of the passion economy, you only need 100 true fans, not 1,000. And I was like, or 1,000 new fans, or sorry, it was 100 or 1,000 true fans, something like that. I think it's 100, not 1,000. So I was like, oh my God, like this is so amazing. If people pay this much, I have this many people at the profile on the list. Like, I wonder if I could make a living doing this. So once that question kind of popped into my head, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then I kept going back and forth. I call it the seesaw of misery. You just cannot like make a decision. But then the thing that I read, And it stuck with me for so long. Jim Cook, who we might talk about later, who started Samuel Adams Beer, one of the things he said that he was making $250,000 working at BCG. He was like, that was comfortable. I was providing for my family. Why would I ever leave? But then when he was deciding whether to leave to start his own brewery, he thought, okay, there's a difference between a scary decision and a dangerous decision. It may be scary to quit your job that you've been at for 5, 10, 15 years. That goes away. The scariness goes away. But danger is you staying in that job and then regretting it when you're 70 years old. Like, damn, what would have happened if I started my own thing? And once I read that and I was like, okay, well, that kind of answers my question for me. And I made the decision. I'm one of those people, once I make a decision, I go through with it. I can't go back. So I made it. I told Fortune immediately, and then I left. Here I am today.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I think you're referring to the 1,000 True Fans, which is like popularized by Kevin Kelly.
Lee Jin. She wrote 100 true. If, like,
that was
forget
the iteration
a thousand,
of it.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, yep. That's what makes it. So, yeah, that's what I was thinking was, like, the original post from Kevin Kelly, who was, like, Wired guy, is, like, a classic in, like, writing. And it's my take on it was you can, if you've got true fans who basically buy everything that you put out, you'll be able to make essentially 100 grand a year or more, which is enough to live. And I think you're referring to, like, an iteration of that, which is today things have changed. The, like, you don't have to just rely on, like, ads, like, we've thought about forever. There's other ways to make money and there's other ways to monetize an audience, essentially. But so we're definitely going to go into some of that later. One of the things, I'm conscious that some people might not have come across the profile, so just if you could, like, share, like, what exactly it is and whatever you're able to share in terms of scale. Like, understandably, you might not be able to share exact numbers, but just so people understand, like, number of subscribers and percentage of those people that pay or something like that.
So the profile is a place where people go to study the most successful and interesting people and companies. And a lot of people actually get upset when I say the word successful, which is really interesting to me, because success in the truest sense of the word is what you make it. Success is such a subjective thing. I think to many people, for example, when I told certain people in my life that I was going to leave Fortune to do the profile full time, they said, but why? Like, you're so successful. And I'm like, but no, I consider myself more successful if I leave to do this thing. And it becomes interesting and creates a community. So we define success for ourselves. And the reason I say successful is, to me, the people who are living their best lives on their own terms, those are the most successful people to me. So basically, we study, you know, all sorts of people across all sorts of industries, whether it's business, fashion, entertainment, sports. And the way we do that is, so there's two newsletters. One comes out on Sunday, in which I curate 8 to 9 deep, long-form profiles of people and companies that came out that week. And then there's a premium layer. I call it the profile membership because it truly is a community of people. When you join this community, you also get two additional sections that are audio and video recommendations. So whether they're podcasts or documentaries that I've seen recently that I really love, etc. And then on Wednesday, for the premium subscribers, I published something called the Profile Dossier. And the Profile Dossier is a deep dive into an individual person. So far, I mean, I don't know how many I've published at this point. I probably started in March every single Wednesday until now. But those are, somebody called it like Cliff Notes on steroids or something like that. But basically, let's pick a person. Elon Musk, I go and I read and I listen and I watch to everything he's kind of done. And then I distill. So after you listen to a person and read about them for a long period of time, you kind of hear the same things over and over again. So I distill those lessons that I feel like are key to their work or their career, the way they live their life. And I have a section called techniques to try, and there's super specific things that I've learned from that person that you can try in your own life. And then we also, like, the profile community have a Telegram group with premium members, and we just talk about, you know, what profiles we've read, ideas we're thinking about. Sometimes there's debates in there. It's really cool. It's a great place to be.
One thing I did want to touch on was just kind of your expectations going in before and after. And I actually took this from one of your profiles. So Ira Glass, who is an amazing kind of like a radio NPR legend, and many people think he's one of the best storytellers of all time. I definitely think he's up there. So he talks about this concept of asking before and after. So I'm curious, like, going into this, like, what did you think it was going to be like? And now in reality, what has it kind of turned out to be like?
I love that you used one of my own, like, dossiers against me. It's great. So I, before I left my job and before I did the profile full time, I really thought that it would be much more relaxed than it is. And I also thought that I would have to be, like, begging people to subscribe. Like, I thought it would be a lot of, like, a struggle to get people on the list. And Because when I was at Fortune, I was writing Term Sheet. Term Sheet is a beast, right? Like that newsletter, people were flocking to it. And I didn't have to sell the advertising. I didn't have to do the back end. I didn't have to figure out like technical glitches. So all the infrastructure was there. All I had to do was get there and write. The difference, what surprised me most in doing the profile, is that I'm responsible for everything, the back end, the front end, the side end, like all of the ends. And I'm also like customer service. When somebody's having an issue, they respond to me. I have to talk to them. And the truth is that I think at Fortune and everywhere else I've worked, I very much used my like creative brain. I never had to think about a business. And now it's truly the reason you don't hear of that many journalists becoming entrepreneurs is because it's a very different skill set. And it is possible though. And I am lucky that I have Anthony to like bounce ideas off of, because he's kind of the opposite of me. Whereas I'm very like, I write and I think and like, oh, but this comma doesn't go here. He'll think about like, okay, but is this the best use of your time right now? Are you doing this because you genuinely enjoy it and want to improve the quality? But are you thinking about like, how is this one thing gonna grow the profile? And it's asking those questions and thinking about using my creative brain, but also my logical brain to sit down. And like, I literally have to get out, like put this thing aside and be like, okay, is this the best use of my time? If it's not, what else could I be doing? And can this be just a more long-term project that I'm not spending 3 days working on full time? It's a lot of time management. And it makes me really appreciate people who start businesses, especially content businesses, in that you not only have to worry about the content, but everything else that comes along with it. But I'm weirdly enjoying it because it's a new skill and I love learning it.
A lot of people don't realize until you've created something from scratch, like how hard it is. Like whether you're starting with a name or not, it's still really difficult. Even if you're Tim Ferriss and you've got 2 million people on your blog and you turn that into one of the most successful podcasts in the world, there were other people like Tim Ferriss who had like a big audience and weren't able to do that. So it definitely is much easier if you've already got something to take people from. And the other kind of thing that stood out to me there was like the skin in the game. Like it sounds a little cliche, but like when you have skin in the game and you're actually quitting your salary, which, you know, is a tough mental decision.
But that's the thing, like when I was working at Fortune, if 100 people unsubscribed from Term Sheet, my salary didn't change. With the profile, like my monthly salary probably will change if 100 people unsubscribed. So it's like those little, you see the direct impact of your work, people will tell you with their dollars.
No, completely. And there's like a feeling, the like high highs and low lows of that, right? Like now when 12 people sign up or 100 people sign up, like you'll probably get a lot more satisfaction out of that than 100 people signing up for Fortune's newsletter.
Completely.
And then the opposite is true as well. So that's really cool to hear. So we'll transition into like your role in the role of like new media and the evolution of media. So you mentioned Substack there. So for people that don't know, Substack is a platform where you can kind of go and create a paid newsletter in like a few clicks. It's like really simple. In a few minutes, you've got it up and running. You don't have to figure out all of the like setting up Stripe and payments and all the SSL security stuff. Like they've done it for you. I'm curious, like when you started the newsletter, was that like a conscious decision looking at Substack versus creating your own one on like MailChimp or on your own website?
I actually wasn't aware of Substack because I started the profile in 2017 and I started with Tiny Letter. Tiny Letter because I like the design and also because I didn't think I would get that many people signed up. But then I hit the limit of what Tiny Letter allows you to do, so I moved on to MailChimp. I think MailChimp owns Tiny Letter. From there, I was on MailChimp, but the deliverability wasn't great. A lot of my, every single week, people were like, it went to spam, where I didn't get it. And I was just like, I'm so tired of this. Like, why is my newsletter, I'm not sending you spam. So that would be like 30% of people. So I started looking for different solutions. And at the same time, so now this is 2018, Hamish, who's the co-founder of Substack, emailed me and he was like, hey, Felina, love the profile. We're building this product. Do you want to be like one of the first people to join? And I was like, no, not interested. I don't have a paid newsletter. And I just like, it was like the rudest email I've ever written. I don't know. I was just like, it's just another startup trying to, at this point, I'm like so fed up with like email providers. I don't want to go to a third. But I ended up going to MailerLite. I don't even know what that is. The deliverability was even worse. Sometimes they'd just be like, yeah, it's not working for 48 hours. And I was like, well, I got to send my newsletter. So, so I was on that. And then I actually told Anthony, because he started a newsletter in 2018. And I was like, you should use Substack. I saw this thing. It's free. Like, you don't have to pay every month. And he was like, oh, okay, cool. So he started using it. And when I saw how clean it was, how it never went to spam, which was so important to me, and everything was taken care of on the back end. And they, because they actually, Hamish and Chris got what writers need. Writers need to be writing. When I had the MailChimp, if you look back at the old issues of the profile, it's horribly designed because they let me design it. And I'm not a designer. I need to write. So I think the cleanliness of it, the design of it, and the fact that Substack, you know, takes care of the back end really appealed to me. And a lot of people will ask, one of the most common questions I get is, well, Substack takes 10% and then Stripe takes 3%. Like, how do you feel about that? Why don't you just do it on your own? My thought process is whenever you decide to do something like a Substack or whatever, be intentional about it. Because I did it when I added a premium layer on in January, I did the math. I was like, hold on a second. If I do this, why would I give up so much, you know, of the revenue? And then when I did the math, I was like, oh, okay, because if I hired a developer and I hired a whatever, or I did it myself, I would have to invest just as much, if not more money for the upkeep and all of that stuff than what Substack charges. So it didn't make sense for me to go do it on my own, but it definitely would for some people. So yeah, that's why I landed on Substack. I just want to write.
So Substack has been like on the edge of what I find like new media, where lots of people have been finding new ways to monetize, right? So if you look at someone like Tim Ferriss, who's been writing forever, he's written books, he had a blog, and that's definitely worked out well for him. And he eventually transitioned to investing and then a podcast. But even his podcast, most of his money is made from advertising still. So I'd say like that model has worked for someone at that scale. But if now we're in an age where so many more people are creating content, and you can have 1/100th of the size of his audience and make as much money nowadays. But there's new ways of doing that. So I'm curious on your opinion, being so close to this, like how do you think of the evolution of like people making money through these sorts of audiences changing?
I think that it became very clear in recent years that the advertising model does not that it doesn't make sense, but it may not be the best solution for media companies, right? And you're kind of dependent on advertisers, advertising revenue, everything like that, except that you're writing for the reader. I'm not writing for Ford. Like, I'm writing for the people reading my work. And it became painfully obvious with the rise of newsletters. Like, I saw it firsthand at Fortune. Fortune had Most Powerful Women, Broadsheet, that newsletter, Term Sheet, Data Sheet, all sorts of newsletters. And I saw the kind of passion that people had when that newsletter would land in their inbox. And when it wasn't there, I saw that they would be like, hey, it's not in my inbox at the time that you said it would be. And that is such an intimate experience, because you never, like, you don't actually get to see the people reading your articles on the website. Very rarely would somebody take the time to email me and say, hey, I read your article on so-and-so on fortune.com. But every single day from that email list, that newsletter, people were so engaged and they felt like they knew you. It came from your name. There's something really personal about it. And especially if you're one of those people like me who would respond to every single email, even if it was a criticism, even if it was something like they didn't like, because that stuff is important too. I think Substack was very smart to notice the trend of, if you look at any survey, people are losing trust in institutions. One of those institutions being legacy media organizations. It's just really hard. It's you know, trust is at an all-time low than it's ever been. And you think about it and you're like, why? Well, it's really hard to trust faceless institutions, and it's really easy to talk crap about these CNN and Fox and whatever, right? But it's not as easy when you know the person, the individual writing that. And I personally, if you think about it, the people that I trust the most are people. They're not faceless organizations. So I think Substack saw the trend of people trust people, therefore people will subscribe to people. And if you think about even your own reading habits, if I ask you who you read, you'll probably name people or reporters at certain organizations versus the entire organization. So, from the reader perspective, I do think that there is something to be said about my dollars, when I sign up for the profile, my dollars are going directly to support Paulina, not a massive organization. And I think people like that. We've all been trending towards this thing. And I think the future of media is actually going to be really interesting, because you're going to see all this unbundling. But there's only so many individuals that can create content that can charge for it. So now what we're starting to see is rebundling. But that rebundling is done with individual personalities. I think it's something, it's similar to what Axios tried to do, but it's in reverse. It's not top down, it's like bottom up. So all these successful individual creators are getting together and they're bundling their offerings and saying, hey, for $20 a year or whatever a month, you can subscribe to this and get like five different newsletters instead of just one.
I've seen it in the press or like people talking about this, but I haven't had someone on the show describe it like that. That's really interesting. Yeah, because I guess if I'm a traditional media organization or even like a new media organization, there's this kind of risk, right? Because they can invest in their individual talent, right? Like say you worked still for Fortune, they could say, okay, we're in an age where people trust the face. We're going to make her the face and we want to invest in her and grow her profile. And hopefully people will keep paying for this newsletter. But then that obviously gives them a little risk that you could leave and start your own thing, which eventually would happen. But that's kind of been, I mean, I think that's been around forever. It's just now the tools are there. So if you were a news anchor for 20 years, now you can actually go and create your own news channel, whereas previously you weren't doing that. So that's a really great way of putting it. What about extending beyond just paying for content? Because I've heard you discuss potentially doing, you've got a community that you mentioned in your Telegram, and even doing like paid events and that sort of stuff. Another area people are looking at are like teaching and courses and stuff like that. But I'm curious, like, if you've explored or thought about any of those.
I don't like the idea of the traditional like course or webinar, but as I'm working on these dossiers, I'm putting together things that I think could be so interesting to create kind of like the profile school or something like that, where you go and you know, like, I will learn by coming here. I want that to be a premium product. But my whole idea is like, I want to keep adding value for the people who are members and who have supported the profile from day one. So I'm thinking of new things to introduce. So the virtual courses or things like that are one such way. But yeah, like for example, up until now, I've curated content, I've written original content, and I've basically pointed people in the direction of like, here's where you can learn more. But I think there comes a point where I'm like, basically, I'm bringing you here. I should just tell you, like, here's what I've learned and here's what you can learn too, instead of like this roundabout way of curating it and saying like, you can go here to learn more and here to learn about this. Like, I want to put it all together. So right now I've been working on the topic of creativity, and creativity is something so mushy and like, so like, you know, if you Google creativity into Google right now, you'll get like 5 really poorly written listicles about how to be creative in 5 ways and 5 steps. And it's always so generic. But my advantage is I've studied these individual people and their individual habits. So I can actually make it super specific and precise and not as generic and mushy as like the internet. So that's my goal. I wanna take these big topics, deconstruct them into really specific ideas, and match them with the people that you can actually learn from.
I definitely agree, because I love the way that you write like techniques to use or lessons to apply.
Techniques to try.
So you say techniques to try, and that takes like this great writing about a person, but then saying like, here's 2 or 3 or 4 things that this person does in their work that you can apply directly to your own life, the way I did with Ira Glass earlier. So definitely recommend that approach. But the second part to that is really just, I think we're also going through an evolution of what education online looks like. So we're going to have Gagan Biani on the show in a few weeks. Well, I'll record next week with him, who started Udemy, and he's now started a new startup, which is all about cohort-based courses. So that means people turn up for like a live session like this, and you actually give people like the room to learn those things and discuss them together. And then there's work offline as well. And it's a hybrid between, you know, like if you just give people the 10 things to watch in their own time, they don't do it most of the time. I think like 95%.
Accountability.
Exactly. So that's the biggest part. I think one of the things that stood out with your work is you read so much stuff and you distill it really beautifully. I saw you said something along the lines of, you read the equivalent of 121 books last year or something like that and summarized them in your profiles. And that's fantastic, but a way of just like making it tangible, because I definitely didn't read 121 books last year. So like, I'd love to go into your process, because I think that's something anyone can learn, whether you're doing your own writing or you're a student or you're starting the company, because we all have to take in a lot of information and figure out what the most important parts are. So like, where do you start with something like this?
This is really interesting, because when I was in school, my least favorite subject, the one that I was just like, ugh, was history, which is ironic because, you know, like a lot of people have existed in history and there's lessons to learn from everyone. But the way it was taught was just extremely inefficient. And I actually think like it was not how I learned best. So the way history is normally taught is like, you're given a concept and then you are told this happened in history. So I personally learn best by studying humans and people in history rather than historical events themselves. So whenever I want to study or to write a dossier on Wednesday, which is a deep dive on an individual, a lot of people think that I start with the person first and then I distill their ideas. But instead, I actually do, what do I want to learn about this week? And then I go backwards and find the person that best embodies that idea. So for example, one week I was like, I want to learn more about originality and creativity and independent thought. When I started Googling around and reading a lot of things, the person that immediately came to mind is Elon Musk. He's incredibly original, incredibly creative, and an independent thinker. Another time I was like, wow, we're living in a really uncertain time. How do I make decisions? And the best person who makes good decisions in uncertain times that came to mind was Annie Duke, who's used to be a professional poker player. Another time, and you'll see those things like coincide with periods of time in my life. So one week I was getting married and I was like, I wonder what makes for a good marriage. And then I don't like the cliche mushy stuff of love that is everywhere on the internet. So I found John Gottman, who is incredibly mathematical in his approach to how he studies successful relationships. And I did a dossier on him the week that I was getting married. So it's just like, honestly, it's what's interesting to me. It's what I want to learn about. And what I often find is that if it's interesting to me, it'll be interesting to people who like the profile because they've learned to trust my taste.
I had Tim Urban on the show recently, the from Wait But Why, and he describes it as writing for a stadium full of Tims. He said, like, and there's different approaches to this, because I also had Cortland from Indie Hackers on 2 days ago, and he said kind of the opposite. He was like, who are you going after? But I think that's different because he's coming at it from like a startup business point of view, whereas like someone like yourself or Tim Urban, you're like writers first, and you're writing primarily first, and then you're having to do the business part, and you're having to make money. But it's not like, let's start a business and find the audience, and I think both can work in different ways. But I think specifically with creative stuff, it's really hard to fake that you're interested in like baseball when you find baseball really boring.
And it's so funny because people always ask me that, and they're surprised when I say, very similar to what Tim said, I don't think about who the reader is when I'm writing. Like, I'm not writing for somebody else, weirdly. And that's, I think, been an advantage because I'm not targeting moms of teenage boys, and that's my audience. And I'm not targeting 70-year-old men who are interested in business. I'm writing for things that I think will be interesting to a curious, intelligent audience, and it works.
The last question on that is really about the edit, because like, I'm curious, like, once you've done your first, you know, draft or whatever you've got to, like, what are the sorts of questions you're asking yourself to say, is this staying in or out?
Yeah, the biggest question is, I'm when I write a first draft, I'm usually much more verbose than I want to be. Like, my sentences are longer, my ideas take forever to, like, because I don't know what I think about something until I write. And once I start writing, I'm like, oh, okay, so that's my opinion on it. So I'm kind of thinking as I'm writing. So then I need to cut out all the fluff of me like, oh, but what about this and this? And things that aren't like super, super specific. So to me, writing is kind of like solving a puzzle. The first draft is just like my thoughts on paper. The second draft is, okay, let's take out everything here that does not need to be in here. And one of the best lessons that I've learned at Fortune from my editor, Adam Leshinsky, he is the most precise person in the world with his words. I turned in like a 17-page draft. He was like, absolutely not. And he said, I can tell that your thinking is sloppy because your writing is sloppy. Mm. And because he understood that I think and I write. So being very precise in the language that you use, and also cutting out unnecessary things that are just in there for your own ego. I just asked myself, does this benefit the reader? Does it support my point? And if it doesn't, it's out. So the things that I write genuinely probably started twice as long, and then I cut them. And the other thing is, like, at Fortune, because I was writing term sheets so early in the morning, for the majority of my time there, I didn't have an editor. So it was my words, which is a lot of freedom and autonomy. But it's also like, if you make a mistake, hundreds of thousands of people will let you know you made a mistake. So it was a lot of pressure, but it taught me to be very, very careful and research everything, and just make sure that the thing on the page was what I wanted to be on the page. So now what I do is I cut it, I edit it, by myself, and then I always, always, always read it out loud, whether it's to myself, but I make Anthony listen because I have another person. So I just will read it out loud to him. Sometimes he'll be like, oh, that sounds weird. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. Or like something's missing. So it's good to read it out loud to catch the mistakes that your eyes don't catch if you're just reading it silently in your head, and also to have another person's feedback. I think Tim Urban, I listened to him on a podcast, he said basically his stuff is so good, mm-hmm. but he doesn't have professional editors. He like sends it to his sister, his mom, and his girlfriend. And by doing that, though, you can take really intricate and difficult topics, like he writes about Neuralink and AI, mm-hmm. and make sure that your mom will understand it. Mm-hmm. That means I will understand it, right? So you need different perspectives and points of view to make sure it makes sense.
This is a question I got from the audience when we asked people on Twitter. It's really about like building your audience like from scratch. So, I mean, I don't know enough about your history in terms of like, did you already have a bit of a following from Fortune magazine before you started the profile?
So definitely, I have to credit Fortune working there and being a reporter and you know, doing panels, going to conferences, all of that builds up your audience, right? So I had the advantage, unlike a lot of Substack writers who are genuinely starting from scratch, I had the advantage of working at a place like Fortune, and before that, this media startup, and before that, CNN, which is where I kind of started getting into Twitter. So because I was at those places and people saw that and they followed my work, when I started the profile, it wasn't that big of an ask of them to sign up for something else I was doing because they already knew my work. So I definitely had the advantage of that. And then also when I left Fortune, I was able to announce in term sheet, hey guys, I'm leaving to do my own thing. You can sign up here. And that was very generous of them to let me do, because a lot of readers who enjoyed my work followed me onto the next thing, which is an interesting and an important point. I had a fear that people were there for the platform and for the brand instead of me and my voice, but it was actually very comforting to know that some people, not all people, but some people will follow you if they like your work, regardless of where you are.
But I guess you've also, over the years since leaving, or the year since leaving, you've still grown your audience. So are there other things that you've done to help grow?
Absolutely. So I have done one, the biggest, I think, drivers for me has been link swaps with other newsletters. Mm-hmm. So I've only done it with newsletters that I love and enjoy and actually read. I never recommend things to the profile readers that I don't like myself. I think that's very sleazy. And also you will end up in the, you know, people won't take you seriously if you're just like, I'm going to include everything. So I have recommended Morning Brew and the newsletter 1440, and I believe The Hustle as well. And they have also included me in their newsletters, and I've gotten a lot of like-minded, interesting readers from that. The other thing that I think is very interesting and smart that people could do is basically my, whatever, 50,000 Twitter followers already know about the profile. The majority know what the profile is. I talk about it all the time. The key is to break out of your own network and get into other people's feeds that may not necessarily know about it, but they would enjoy it. So one thing that I did was you want to always like show off your work. So I tweeted, hey guys, like, you know, I claim that I read thousands of profiles every year, but like, why are you supposed to believe me? Here's how I can prove it to you. And I say, give me a topic or an idea that you want to learn more about, and I'll respond to your tweet with a profile to read where you can learn more about that idea. That was really awesome because so the tweet went viral, and everyone who responded, I obviously couldn't respond to everybody, but I really tried. But the people who responded, some people were like, Red Solo Cup. And I was like, all right, come on. But actually, there was a profile on the Red Solo Cup Air from however long ago, and I was able to respond with that. It's the ability to take something and like show off, like, hey, I've read about this, or I know, like, this is my craft. Let me prove it to you. And people thought like I was a bot at one point, which was a really big compliment. But it worked. So find ways to show off your work and your talent in ways that you can actually help people, and then the ask of subscribe to my newsletter is much easier than normal.
Just to switch gears a bit, so thanks for sharing all your knowledge there. on the writing side, we're going to talk about some of my favorite lessons from the profile. And again, for the sake of time, we can't go through a full detailed summary of every single guest, every single write-up, but I wanted to pull out my kind of highlights. So let's just kick it off with Malcolm Gladwell, one of my favorite writers. He talked about this concept of creative recipes for storytelling. And this one line you wrote in there, which he said was, "For every hour I spend writing, I spend 3 hours thinking about writing." And that really stood out to me because I was like, first of all, I probably need to do more of that. And when I say writing, I don't just mean actually writing on a piece of paper. Like when I do podcasts, I count that as a form of, like when I translate this into a show, I write like a bunch of show notes. We do timestamps. We try to turn them into clips and lessons learned. So that's kind of the lens I'm looking at it from. But I'm curious, like, why did that resonate so much with you? And has that been your experience as well as a writer?
Yes, I think working in newsrooms for so long, I saw so many reporters pitch half-baked story ideas. Things that they're like, oh, this could be interesting. It's like, yeah, but why? And obviously you haven't spent enough time thinking about it to actually write a good story on it. So I think, similar to Malcolm, what I do is it takes me a while. Like when you see something published in the profile, I've probably thought about that for 3 weeks beforehand. In for example, there was one article I wrote about how the language you speak can actually influence your personality. So people who speak multiple languages can be kind of a different person in one language and a totally different. So for example, for me, I speak Bulgarian. That was my first language. And then I learned English. When I speak currently to this day Bulgarian, I feel a little bit like introverted and a little bit more direct with people. I don't sugarcoat things as much as I do in English. I'm not as extroverted and loud and independent and like take up room and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's the cultural norms or like when I'm speaking that language, I kind of just like jump back in time and, you know, interact with my family and people in Bulgarian that way. So that literally started as an observation about myself, but then I started researching it. I started talking to everybody I knew about it. So my friends who spoke different languages, I was like, has this been your experience? But you find that the more people you talk to, the more they'll be like, ooh, have you read that article on this and watched this movie on that? So somebody pointed me to this short story that inspired the movie Arrival, where a linguist tries to decode the language of aliens. It's so amazing, but it had so many good things I could take away from my article. So that literally took a month of thinking about writing it before I actually sat down. I was like, I'm ready.
I love that one for sure. Thanks for sharing that. I think for me, it's also, it's just a general concept that not just for writing, but overall, like if you're going to spend time doing something, do it well, but that takes time to figure out like what the right approach is and being thoughtful and proactive about it. I could definitely do more of that myself. The next one was around being interesting, not perfect. And that sounds so simple, but I think it's something everyone can gain from. I'm curious like why you included that and what you kind of took from it.
Yes. So growing up as an immigrant child, when I came here, didn't speak English, didn't have friends, I very much thought that if I could be perfect and blend in, and I don't even know what I thought perfect meant, but like basically just be like everybody else and blend in, like I wouldn't have trouble and I wouldn't have problems and people wouldn't like pick me out and be like, she's weird. So I over-rotated in the sense that I became like perfect and I had friends, I was well-liked, like all this kind of stuff, but it felt like I was kind of one person on the inside and like, you know, very likable and I never disagreed on the outside. And that's like a very weird cognitive dissonance type thing. So when I, you know, I obviously eventually evolved and grew out of that and moved to New York and I was suddenly like, I think this and you're wrong. And I I had all the opinions. But no, I think that reading that Malcolm Gladwell said basically the best pieces of art, the best books, the best music is the ones that are somewhat flawed and not perfectly blended together that make an impact on you and they're memorable and they're interesting and people are fascinated by them. Because honestly, the most interesting people that I know in my life don't have perfect hair and they don't look like everybody else. I'm not impressed by that. I'm not interested in that. I'm fascinated by their brain. And I think that absolutely agree that you shouldn't strive for perfection. You should strive for intellectual play, as Malcolm Gladwell puts it.
The last one from Malcolm was around finding meaning in your work. And I thought this was really useful because he said that three things that are needed. One is autonomy, two, complexity, and three, a connection between effort and reward. So maybe we can just go into that a little bit more. I think autonomy sounds pretty obvious, like you need some autonomy in your work. Number two, complexity, I think is a little bit more, like not everyone would agree with that. So again, curious on your take from what he said.
I think you need complexity and you need to be challenged in your work, because I think the example that Malcolm gives is like, okay, if I paid you $100,000 a year to be a toll booth person, that requires no complexity. You're just doing the same thing, but that gets really, really boring and also kind of like dangerous for your, you know, development as a human being. So if I paid you much less, but you get to be the owner of your dream company, you would take that because there's a level of complexity and you're challenged every day.
Especially our generation, we really struggle with, is like you hit a certain point where you become comfortable for a lot of people, whether that is, you know, your financial income or just like your actual learning curve slows down and you can do your job. Like I've done this myself where I could do my two jobs ago, I could do that like with my eyes closed and I just wasn't challenged. And it takes quite a little. That was one of the three things. You need some complexity in your work and I didn't have that. So I think that's a great framework for people to think through those three things. Just to move on to Ira Glass, again, we mentioned him earlier. This quote was so good, I almost tweeted it like at midnight last night. So, great stories happen to those who can tell them. I thought that was brilliant.
Right? There's so many. Everybody has an amazing story. It's just very few people can tell them well.
And then the second part to your right up there, you mentioned, he says, ask the same questions more than once. Question over and over and over and over again. And just as someone who does this 2-3 times a week, I would say I definitely agree. Because often you ask someone a question and they'll give you an answer and then you kind of need to go one layer deeper. And then it's kind of awkward to do it, but sometimes you need to go a third or fourth time and then you truly get to the question. Was that kind of like your understanding of it too? So you obviously do this for your work too. So
absolutely. And I think it's because a lot of people have a talk track that they're used to. They say in every episode, and I think the reason, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason that your interviews are somewhat long form is because you find that the first 30 minutes are kind of awkward and you're getting to know each other. But then once the person trusts you as a host, they're just like, you earn their trust, but also they're willing to go deeper and to answer things more honestly. That's why, like for my interviews at Fortune, if I only got 30 minutes with the person, I just knew I would get the high level generic stuff, especially very well media trained CEOs. But give me like an hour and a half or a whole day and I will like dig up their childhood fears and we'll get to really know each other. And I do think that trust and time in asking things over and over again have a really big role to play.
Yeah, that's such a great insight. And I 100% agree, because I've heard Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss both say this, that the first 45 minutes are essentially like not dead time, but people are still going through their PR story. Like they've got these stories they tell. And a lot of the time they're really entertaining and fun. But like the whole point of my show is to go deeper beyond that. And that's why I book that amount of time, so we can talk a little bit before and we can get to know each other. And then eventually we get to the point where you start sharing stuff that they weren't just on your PR list of things to say. And that's not to cat someone out. It's just to get to the real truth, you know. So the next one I had on here was Charlie Munger. So definitely one of my favorite people. And you had so many references to stuff in there that I've never read before or seen before. So really brilliant one. If you're going to sign up for the profile, I would check this one out. One of the first ones. So for people who don't know, he's Warren Buffett's partner. One of the things you mentioned, he said, avoidance of stupidity is more important than the pursuit of excellence. I thought that was hilarious.
So Charlie Munger's fascinating because the way he thinks is brilliant in that he says so many of us try to be better or smarter or, you know, more talented, when in fact we can solve a lot of our own problems by just being less dumb and making fewer mistakes rather than trying to improve all the time. So for example, one easy example is, let's say you're in a relationship and you want to be a better husband, boyfriend, whatever, and you're like, how can I be better? What can I do? But then instead, maybe ask yourself, what are the bad habits I have right now that I can stop doing that will naturally just make me better instead of just adding on? And I always try to approach every situation in that way. Like, instead of adding more to my plate, what is something that I can change right now that I'm doing that is bad or hurtful or takes up too much time? In that way, you can automatically make the product better, your work better, by just eliminating the bad instead of adding more good.
One of the lessons you mentioned was be a survivor, not a victim. And there's a fine difference between the two and like the mentality towards a bad situation. So I'm curious if you could just share like what your take was on that one.
Yes. So he has been through a lot in his life that a lot of people don't know, right? So for example, he had a marriage that failed at age 29. He lost a child to cancer. And then he had cataract surgery on his eye that left him like with horrible pain. And he had to get his eye taken out. So those are things that if Charlie approached it in one way would be very different than how he approached it. He could have gone the route of, oh my God, look at all that's happened in my life. It's so unfair. I'm so unfortunate. I have such bad luck. Everybody else gets this and I don't get that. But instead, what he did was he took it and used it as an opportunity to say, look at everything I've been through and look at everything I've built. And it's made me stronger and better because of it. But those are slightly different mentalities, but one is so much more powerful than the other because the other one puts you in the defensive rather than the offensive.
One of my favorite people, and RIP to him, is Anthony Bourdain. And I think anyone who's watched his shows or read his books, just it's kind of hard not to love the guy. And there were so many in this one. And you talked about the Bourdain principle. And it was about sharing a meal. Would you be able to just share like what you learned from Anthony Bourdain?
Yes. So Anthony Bourdain, basically, one of his biggest lessons that he's learned is that when you travel to places, you shouldn't be a snob about it. So it's very easy to come from the United States, go to a different place and say, oh, the toilets here aren't clean and the whatever. It's just, by doing that, you put distance between you and the people that you're sharing the experience with, and that experience for him being a meal. And I think the coolest thing that he said is that basically wherever he goes, he has made a rule for himself. I will try whatever they put in front of me, because by sharing a meal with a person, it's a very intimate experience in that everybody drops their, you know, defenses, and they're willing to be vulnerable and willing to talk about things. So he says, never forget that the meal that you're eating is nowhere nearly as important as where you're sitting when you're eating it and who you're eating it with. And I think what I wrote in that article is that basically, I'll never remember the meals that I actually had with like friends and family, but I'll always remember some of the conversations that were had over a meal. It is just so much easier to share things and ask questions when you're eating, because it's like a casual experience. It's not as serious as sitting in a desk and somebody looking at you. I think food is one of those things that opens your eyes to different cultures and beliefs and opinions, and it's amazing.
That's beautifully put. And something I heard the other day was we were discussing the difference between cultural appropriation, which is quite a hot topic nowadays, and cultural integration. And the person I was speaking to, Cortland Allen from Indie Hackers, you know, we were talking about like what Anthony Bourdain's talking about here, which is be in someone else's shoes for a day or for an hour and like go and eat with them and understand their world a little bit and be in their environment. And I think that would do a lot of benefit to the world. It would make us all more empathetic to each other. Was there anything else from Bourdain that really stood out? I know you talked about the don't be a snob go rogue when you travel. Was there anything else that you really liked from him?
Yes. So one thing that I thought was interesting is that he had always been extremely open about his life and his previous like indiscretions. So when he wrote the book Kitchen Confidential, he talked about being addicted to heroin and doing all these drugs and these like crazy things that he did. But he says, you know, when he published that, it was weirdly freeing because suddenly it was all out there and your worst critic or hater or somebody who's just doesn't like you, no matter what they say about that, they'll be like, well, you're a drug addict, and he'll be like, okay, like I know that you're it doesn't hurt me in a way. Whereas if you're trying to be perfect and you're trying to hide all your imperfections and previous stuff, it's always going to come out. But when it comes out, how you react to it really, really matters. And I think we liked Bourdain because he was willing to be authentic in the sense of, I made mistakes, I've learned from them, here I am today, I know I'm lucky to be in this position, not everybody gets this, but he wasn't ever defensive about what he did, and I think that's a really great weapon for somebody to have.
No, and I think especially in like 2021 or whatever year we're in when you're listening to this, we've kind of got past the stage of expecting everyone to be perfect, because I think in an age where there were 5 TV channels and a few radio stations and 5 publications, we would just see like famous people as this separate world. And especially the people who tried to pretend they were perfect, I think like politicians are a great example of this. If you look at like Obama, he wrote a book before he ran for president that said he smoked a little ganja in his life, you know, like,
right, like it's not good. Yeah.
And he got ahead of it because he was smart. Whereas if you were someone who's trying to be holy and pretend like you've never done anything wrong, like, first of all, most people are skeptical of those people. But two, like, you can't really relate to it because everyone's done silly things in their life. So definitely worth reminding ourselves of that one. And then the last couple of ones, I know we're going through quick hit greatest hits here, but thanks for sharing all these.
No, I love this.
Shonda Rhimes. So for those people who don't know, who is Shonda Rhimes? And like, were there a few things that you really learned from that one?
Shonda is an amazing TV producer, show writer, showrunner. She's behind How to Get Away with Murder, Grey's Anatomy, like some of the most addicting TV shows on the planet. And she, she's like a powerhouse in that she does not care what you think about her life or her choices. So there, one of the lessons I put in there was normalize your life. A lot of people are still very worried about, oh, well, I don't want to have kids. Like, how is that going to look? Just don't have kids. You don't want to get married? Don't get married. Like, all these cultural norms, who's to decide that you're supposed to abide by this, this, and this? In 2021, great year to be like, you know what, I'm just going to live life my way and I'm going to normalize it for myself. And the other thing based off that I really liked from her is she basically said, put yourself in environments where your desired behavior is the normal behavior. So when I was, yeah, it takes a little bit to, when I was thinking about doing the profile full time, I could have spent my days going to friends and family and who didn't understand anything about the newsletter business and explaining, so I have this newsletter and it's going to be paid and here's why it's a good idea, and convincing them. Or I could go and join groups of existing Substack writers who have made it work and actually iterating and talking about ideas with them. That was the normal behavior for them. For them, they're past the, is this a good idea or not? So choose what environments you want to live in, because if you're hanging out with the people who are like, I don't get it, you'll doubt yourself. Go to the place where like, this crazy idea is just the norm and you are actually not as crazy as everybody else in there.
A lot of people listening to this are entrepreneurs or people wanting to start companies. And everyone goes through this phase right in the beginning where you have this idea and you want to say, you want to tell everyone you know, right? And you say, look at this idea. It's brilliant. I've thought about it forever and I know all the details. And 95% of those people are not the right people. Like, and it's fine if you've got thick skin and you can share it and like take their feedback with a pinch of salt. But a lot of people do that and then they just get turned off. And even just one example for me is this podcast. Like, my podcast should not be applicable to 98% of my friends and family, because most of them aren't starting companies and they're not like interested in this stuff at this level. So I think when I kind of took my, when I made a change and said, okay, I'm not like making it for my mom and dad to enjoy, even though I want them to love it. It's not primarily for them. It's for this sort of person and someone who's like me. It makes a huge difference. So that's a really great lesson. The one other thing that she mentioned was, I'm no longer looking for an enemy, so I no longer see the enemy. And that one kind of hit me pretty hard, because it kind of reminded me of when I was quite young. I definitely had a bit of a them and us sort of mentality. And to be really honest, it came from like experiencing a lot of racism growing up. And I just kind of grew up with this resentment and saying, okay, well, forget those people. I'm going to prove them wrong. And I'm not like them. And it was, maybe it helped me and it motivated me for a few years, but it made me like really resentful and kind of angry as a kid. So that one kind of hit me, because when I was able to actually let go of that, and it sounds a bit sad, but I watched this movie, American History X, but there's a moment in there, I don't want to spoil it, but you realize like, okay, just by being angry and hateful or whatever, it's not going to end well for you, you know? And I think having that them and us mentality really, really is destructive for a lot of people. So I just wanted to share that as well.
Absolutely. And I've had the same thing, because again, as an immigrant kid to this country, I was like severely, you know, but you understand other kids are mean to you because you're weird and you're different and et cetera. And it's funny. I've had this play out. It always comes from an insecurity, right? Like it's always like, well, for me, at least, I'm convinced that I'm good at writing, because I was like, you know what? I can't speak your language or read right now, but like, I'll be better than you. And I overdid it, where I actually did become better than some of them. So I think it's good to have a little bit of that competitive edge, but also know, if you know that it comes from an insecurity, the way you can defeat it is by meeting those people and being like, ah, oh, shoot, I kind of like you. You know what I mean? Like it that kills the anger and the everybody's like this.
That actually brings me on to the next one from Guy Raz, the also a podcast guy, who's got How I Built This Podcast, brilliant podcast. Guy Raz talked about figuring out the story you're telling yourself. So if you've ever read any self-development book or psychology book, you kind of would have heard of a similar concept. But I'm curious, like, one, did that one stand out to you for any particular reason? And did it make you reflect on yourself and say, are there stories I'm telling myself that I need to kind of change?
Yes, and that really hit home recently when I did another interview with somebody named Noah Galloway, who's a veteran. He went to Iraq, came back. He basically... veterans and a lot of other people, when you have something significant happen in your life, whether it's traumatic or really, really great, a time where you shined and you were the star football player, etc., it's easy to stay in that place and just decide that that's the person you're going to be. Have you read the book Educated?
I haven't, but I know the book, and I know you've liked it because I heard you mention it before.
Yes. So I just want to mention one part in it. Tara Westover wrote the book from her perspective right now as a 20-something-year-old, let's say 29-year-old. But then she incorporates diary entries from when she was 16. And when she writes the diary entry, when she reads it at 29, she's like, oh my God, I'm kind of a different person than I was at 16. But in your head, sometimes you're still that like 16-year-old that's like, oh, like I'm angry and me. But you fail to realize that you don't have to be angry or sad or whatever anymore, because time has gone on. You're a different person. You've had different experiences and they've shaped you into who you are. But I do think a lot of people get stuck at one age. For me, for a long time, that was 8 years old, when I didn't have friends and I was kind of like introverted and shy. And it took a long time for me to be like, I don't have to be like that anymore.
Do you mind me asking, have you ever done therapy before or like...
I haven't.
Okay, cool. A big part of that whole process is like figuring out the stories you're telling yourself, especially from childhood, because they kind of stay with you forever unless you like consciously... I've like worked on it, but that doesn't have to be only through a therapist. So thanks for sharing that anyway. The last one we'll go into is Elon Musk. We're going to run out of time soon. So everyone's favorite entrepreneur. There were like three things I'd love to go into. The first one was this concept of the chef versus the cook. And Tim Urban wrote about this in his great post as well with him, but we didn't actually get to talk about it that day. So I'd love for you to share, like, what was the difference between the chef and the cook and why you should be one over the other?
So Tim is a freaking amazing writer, and I got to meet him once. Oh, and wow. I asked him what he thought about Elon Musk. He spent so much time with him, and he basically said, Elon Musk is the most original thinker I've ever met, and he understands that originals are a total mess. Nobody created anything original that wasn't just a disaster in the very beginning stages, right? But Elon is one of those rare humans who's willing to do that and not worry about how will this make me look. Whereas I think, like, if I was in his shoes, I'd be like, oh my God, what are people writing? What are they saying? So he's able to put that aside. And the difference in what Tim writes about the cook versus the chef is that most people are cooks. We have an idea, we want to do something, and then we go follow a recipe on how to do it best. But somebody's already created that before. Somebody's already gone down that path before. The reason that Elon Musk is so original and so creative is because he's a chef. He doesn't follow the recipe, he invents the recipe. And he has to put ingredients together in the beginning that just don't make sense and they don't work out. But eventually, after so many iterations, he's going to land on that one recipe that like works and it's great and other people want to copy. So that's what makes him super original.
It can be applied to so many different worlds. Like even in the business world, not only are you doing the work, but you're taking a step back and you're saying, what does this recipe look like that I'm going through myself? Okay, cool. There's a big process here. How can I reinvent this? How can I remix it, make it look better, make it taste better? And then maybe I'm going to bring in a few cooks to help me. And I really love that metaphor for that reason.
And you know what's interesting is I always thought that I was like very independent thinker and very original until I sat down and I was like, oh crap. Like I just assumed that I've never asked myself, what is a profile? I just always assumed it was written text in a magazine. Like, who decided that? A profile can be what we're doing right now. Mm. It can be, you know, what Humans of New York does, where it does like a deep dive on a person in their own words. But who decides what a profile is? And I want to kind of like, I'm in the process of thinking about that. And like, what is the future of what we think a profile on a human is?
Actually, you kind of talked about his original thinking, and one of the primary reasons for that is he uses first principles in his thinking. And this is something I think a lot of people hear the phrase and they don't always fully understand what it means. So like I'd love for you to share like what you took from Elon's example. I think you had mentioned like something about being afraid of the dark as a kid, or I don't know if that relates to this, but yeah, what did you take from that part?
Yes, I think what turns off many people in learning something new is that they start the wrong way. They start with the details and then try to back into learning whatever they're learning. You'll never learn physics if you're like deep into it. You have to start with the really basic, general, like a big view of physics and the world and how it works, etc., before you get down into the details. And I think Elon uses a metaphor of a forest and a tree and the leaves and the branches. Basically, you need to start big and then zoom in as you understand it, not the other way around. So for example, when he was little, he used to be afraid of the dark, which if you understand the way Elon thinks, is that he's not a very emotional thinker. That's a very emotional thought. I'm scared of the dark. So then he was like, wait a second, But what is the dark? Why is it dark? And then after a while, he understood that dark is just a lack of photons. And he was like, what does it make sense to be afraid of a lack of photons? And he's fine now. And it just forces you to think, how many of our fears and our things that we don't want to do are just driven by irrational emotions, right? And if you actually sit down and explain to yourself, why am I afraid of this? And scientifically speaking, why am I reacting this way to X stimulus? You won't be as afraid or as worried as whatever, because you've explained it to yourself in a very scientific terms. And once you're able to rationalize it to yourself, you'll become less of an emotional decision maker.
I love that story so much. One, because it's really funny thinking of Elon as a kid saying that. But also, it just kind of like, it's a story that you'll remember forever, because it's like absence of photons. Like, how can you forget that? One other way I would describe it from my understanding is just like taking your bias away from a situation, which we all have, and trying to say like, well, we think it's this one way of doing things, but like, why are we doing that in the first place in this way? And one example I think Tim Urban shared in his post was like an archaeologist or someone who's looking at like fossils or whatever. If they were basing like the time, like the duration of time that humans have been around just on the Bible, they would have a very different understanding of their work, right? And they had to say, well, actually, maybe the time that was explained in the Bible was X amount of time, but what we're seeing here is something very different. And I think everyone gets that example, because you understand, okay, you got to go by what the fossils are telling us. But like 100 years ago, you wouldn't do that. You would say, well, the Bible told us it's X amount of time, or any religious text, and therefore our experiment must be incorrect. And I think people do that all the time. Elon did it with SpaceX, where they said, well, you couldn't do XYZ, and they said, well, what if we could just land a rocket like this? And they found a way to do it. So thanks for sharing that. I think that's really brilliant. The last one from Elon, which we'll wrap up on, is the difference between human hardware and software. I really thought this was useful. So like, what was your understanding of how we described that and how we could apply it to ourselves?
Absolutely. So he explains, so when Elon Musk looks at someone, he sees a computer. And it's actually a very effective way to think of people, because you're born with hardware, which is your brain, which is genetics from your parents, etc. But then there's the software. And if you think of software like an iPhone, every year it gets updated, right? With new and better information, better inputs. And if you think about your brain like that, the software that you download is basically the content that you consume on a daily basis. So if I, sitting here, didn't consume, so I'm the person I am today because I consume, the media I consume, I'm very intentional about, and I read profiles of people, profiles of companies. I read all sorts of stuff that I disagree with and I agree with. But if I was sitting here and the content that I consumed was just The Bachelorette, just Love Island, just Tiger King, you would be speaking to a very different person, even though I was born with the same brain. It's the type of software that I choose to install that makes me who I am and makes me interested in the certain things that I'm interested in. So Musk's point is, the software that you download can shape the hardware that your brain becomes and the tool that it becomes. And it, as you consume more and better and high quality information, it will be a very sharp tool, whereas it can become soft and kind of not as effective if you're only consuming garbage.
No, I can't agree with that more. And I think it's a great way to wrap things up, because people should go and upgrade the software right now and sign up for...
Perfect.
That wasn't even planned. Go subscribe to the profile. Where can we send people to do that?
Readtheprofile.com.
Readtheprofile.com. Well, thanks again for spending so much time. And I think we covered so many amazing things in this conversation. And I think people are going to love this one. Look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.